Who'd your girls ask to the Sadie Hawkins dance? Cherry, who'd you ask?
Stanley Knuckleboard.
You're willing to be seen in public with Noodle Nose Knuckleboard?
Yeah! And don't call him Noodle Nose. Stanley looks that way because the doctor dropped him after he was born.
Now with me, you get undamaged goods. So what do you say, sweet lips? Take me, I'm yours.
I just wanted to let you know about my study group.
Oh, don't be a fuddy-duddy. I'll be your study buddy.
I'm about to embark on one of the great challenges of my scientific career.
This work right here is going to change history.
I think this is going to be our greatest mission.
I don't have time to study. I'll never get into Stanford.
I got big plans for you tonight. I got maps. I got charts. I got to see you through this because my credibility is on the line.
It's at this point that you'll want to start taking notes.
Welcome to the Sitcom Study, the podcast where we contemplate the TV shows we grew up with and search for the truth and wisdom within the tropes and cliches. And Amy, I will ask you to ask me to ask you, what is the trope we're talking about today?
Well, Jay, I was wondering if you would like to go to the Sadie Hawkins dance day party with me.
Yes, that is exactly what we are doing. We are talking about school dance episodes, colon, Sadie Hawkins edition.
That's right.
If you're alluding to the fact that we don't actually get to the dances.
And most of them aren't even described as dances. It's Sadie Hawkins Day. Sadie Hawkins Party.
We will get into the rich history of Sadie Hawkins and the crazy reversal of having the women ask the men or the girls ask the boys to the dance, the race, the party, whatever it is.
But will we listen to the iconic song?
What's the iconic song?
As I lay me down to sleep.
Clearly, we've got a lot to discuss here. What are our shows?
Okay, our shows, we're going to start off early with The Donna Reed Show, Season 4, Episode 37, The Man in the Mask. Punky Brewster, Season 3, Episode 16, This Spud's for You. Parker Lewis Can't Lose, Season 1, Episode 6, The GAG Dance. And Strangers with Candy, Season 1, Episode 5, Bogey Nights.
Yeah. Now, I'll ask you the question that I discovered the answer to mere minutes ago. Where does this term originate? Are you familiar with Sadie Hawkins, the person?
I am not. Isn't there like a movie about it, I think? And it's like, what's that, Leap Year?
Strap in.
Got it.
I looked this up thinking this was going to be someone along the lines of a Susan B. Anthony or something. This was going to be some sort of historical figure that was like the Rosa Parks of school dances.
No,
and she was like first person to ever ask a boy, and they said it couldn't be done, but she marched through them while they spit in her face. No. This originates from a Lil Abner comic strip.
I didn't know that's where it originated, though.
Yes, it was. And so I was fascinated by this, that it didn't exist prior to this cartoon, but then over the course of a decade or two was so popular that real life people all over the world were doing this.
Yeah, right? No. Okay, so I did Lil Abner in high school. Very familiar with that show. And then, of course, from doing that show, learned about the comic strip and stuff. I had no idea that's where Sadie Hawkins originated, though.
Yeah. So when I looked this up, it takes me to a animated short, which I think would have been one of the things that you would see back in the day. Like you would go to the movies for like 7 hours and there'd be the newsreel and all that and your little, you know, Superman short subject or whatever. And you would see these Lil Abner cartoons. And the synopsis is as follows. It is approaching mid-November in Dogpatch, and this is bad news for all the bachelors, including Lil Abner, as Sadie Hawkins Day is nearing. That's the day that all the bachelors in Dogpatch have to run in the race in which all the unmarried homely gals, which is all of them except Daisy Mae Scragg and Moonbeam McSwine, and old maids and grass widows then chase the bachelors and can marry the one they catch before sundown. Confirmed bachelor Lil Abner, as always, is the prime target as the prize catch, and Daisy Mae, as always, has a new plan that will ensure she catches him. So right. This is like something out of Shirley Jackson's The Lottery, like this crazy tradition in this weird town that's like all the homely old gals chase the bachelors and they marry the one they catch at sundown. Like, this is right. Wild.
Well, that's also the plot of the show, the musical Lil Abner.
Okay.
It's all about the big day.
Like, this is news to me.
That is the plot of the show.
Okay. Well, that helps explain why it caught on like wildfire. So every time you see these Sadie Hawkins things in real life or in TV and movies and stuff, it is a reference to Lil Abner. He came up with this whole thing. Okay. Now that we've got that context settled, what is your experience with this? Did you have Sadie Hawkins dances or parties or anything like that when you were growing up?
Yeah. So I think I've mentioned this before, but at my high school, there was a sorority, and the sorority would throw, like, nobody really went to homecoming. Homecoming was for underclassmen. The juniors and the seniors would, the big dance for the juniors and the seniors in the winter was Silver Bell, which was thrown and hosted by the sorority. And it was a non-school sanctioned event because it was hosted by this sorority that wasn't technically school affiliated, but was, because all of the members came from our school. So that was the big dance. And that was a Sadie Hawkins dance. Like, the girls had to be the ones to buy the tickets and ask their dates.
Huh. Interesting. I feel like in general, I was sold a false bill of goods by TV and movies in terms of the prominence of school dances in my life. Like, you know, I would watch Saved by the Bell aspirationally, as many people did. That show is not really meant for teenagers, right? It's meant for younger kids. And all those John Hughes movies and everything. And every movie, you know, and half the episodes of Saved by the Bell, there's a dance. Back to the Future, all about a dance. Everything's a dance. We had canteens in my school. They called them canteens. This was middle school.
Middle
school?
Okay.
Yeah. And the cafeteria would be devoted to dancing. And just to reference our last episode, this was heavy into the days of Belle Biv DeVoe,
oh, heck yeah,
MC Hammer, etc.
Yes.
And, you know, the kid and play was being done by one and all. And then the gym would be open for gym stuff. So just all the different ways that
so you
a 12
could, like,
or 13-year-old
not,
kid...
If you didn't want to hang out and dance or feel awkward, you could go to the gym.
Yeah, one way or the other, you are going to stink by the end of the night. This place reeked. I just remember, like, that was the first time I experienced that thing of walking into a big room where there's lots of sweaty people and
teenagers,
just kind of having it hit you. Yeah. And so, yeah, that's what we had. And then...
But was it after school, like at night?
Yes.
Or was it like sixth period, seventh period?
No. It was a proper thing that you got dressed up and you went to. It was like 7 to 9 p.m.
But you got dressed up and then went to the gym?
Or the cafeteria, depending on whether you wanted to dance or play basketball.
Well, as I'm saying, so you get dressed up and then go play basketball.
Yeah, I mean, not dressed up like suit and tie, but, you know, all of us seventh graders, eighth graders were, yeah, wearing our coolest stuff.
I love this.
Now, in high school, we had a homecoming dance that I never went to. I don't think most of my friends went to that. And we had a senior prom. Yeah, there was not this thing like, oh, hey, this weekend is the Hawaiian dance. And oh, next week is the Enchantment Under the Sea dance. And then I'll get ready for the, you know, the Ice Mountain dance. Like, that wasn't a thing.
So I just always, okay, particularly the Enchantment Under the Sea, which is the Back to the Future dance. Like, to me, that was prom. Like, you can tell by what they're wearing. Like, that was just the theme for their prom.
Let's get into it. Let's start with the Donna Reed Show.
Okay, so first time on the podcast, we've got Donna Reed. So this show is like 1956 or 1958, something like that, runs until 1966. Donna is a very different middle class mom. She's this icon. We know her as this like iconic kind of Betty Crocker, you know, woman now, but back in the time, she was different because she was a much more complex character. She had a bit of a personality. She wasn't just like waiting at home for the dad or whatever. The show was about her. She was in the center. Not so much this one, but...
No, not at all this one, but this starts is way
off,
into it.
Yeah, but it starts off with a good conversation between her and her son, where we get a little taste of this, where she is much more of like the advice giver in the family. She is much more the one that it, like, kind of has it all together. And her husband, he's a pediatrician and he works out of the home, and they've got two kids, Shelley Fabre, who we saw just a few weeks ago on Coach. This is where she got her teen idol start. And then the other son, who I don't know.
Yeah, the one who this episode is all about. You right. mean? Yeah, it's a little bit like what we talked about with Leave It to Beaver when we watched that. This is a show that, for people now, its reputation precedes it as an old, corny, you know, black and white. Does you hear Donna Reed all the time? Ah, she ain't no Donna Reed. You know, like that's meant to have this certain connotation.
Of like upholding stereotypical gender roles. But like I said, at the time, this was breaking ground in that she was a person with a brain who had a complex character and would, you know, make her voice heard.
Yeah, I think more than anything, it's just like she became emblematic of the 50s, early 60s sitcom mom. Like she was just the one. So now when people think, oh, you're like something out of an old sitcom, like that's what they think. We do not get much of Donna at all in this episode. It's going to be about her kid. Now, the good conversation that you mentioned, this is how the episode starts. It's her talking to her teenage boy, who is going to be the main character of this episode. I get big Patrick Bateman vibes off this kid in this scene. That's the guy from American Psycho. He's going, you know, he's talking about the Sadie Hawkins dance. He's saying, none of the girls have asked me yet. I was hoping Angie would ask me. And Donna Reed, his mom, goes, well, you haven't been very nice to her. I heard you say, hey, stupid, just the other day in the parking lot. And he looks at her dead-eyed and goes, what's wrong with that?
Yeah. Yes, he does. And she's like, well, you know, if you want the girls to like you and ask you to dances and things, girls like manners, I think is what she said, right? She said, girls...
Yeah, she says a few things like manners, respect, courtesy. Like, yeah. She's just saying, be a decent person.
Yeah, I think so. And it's like her big point, though, is that if you want to win a girl over, manners are the most important thing. And he's like, whatever, mom, like just isn't hearing it. He's like, okay. And then he kind of changes the subject and sets up the show in which he has an interview with superstar baseball player Don Drysdale, actually played by Don Drysdale.
Yes, he's indignant that his mom has never heard of Don Drysdale. Now, I had never heard of Don Drysdale, but any question as to whether or not he is a real-life athlete is immediately dispelled later on when he comes into the scene and starts talking.
When we see how bad his acting is.
Yes, there is no way that an actor, you know, made it through the casting process to play this part. So he is a real-life famous ball player that, yes, this kid has an appointment to interview.
Interview for the school paper. And there's a funny little button on the end of this scene where, you know, he sticks his head back in and he's like making fun of his mom, going, who's Don Drysdale? And earlier in the conversation, he had been like, did anybody call? And she was teasing him like, oh yeah, you know, Errol Flynn and Winston Churchill and all these people. And he sticks his head back in at the end and he's like, who's Don Drysdale?
Yeah.
Who's Winston Churchill?
And the thing is, I don't know at this time, like, is Don Drysdale the, you know, Jeter, A-Rod of his day? Is this a superstar or is this just some professional ball player that they got to be in their show?
Yeah, I mean, he is a Dodger. He was in a bunch of movies as well. He was in that Greatest American Hero movie. Do you remember that?
Based on his performance in this? I don't know.
Yeah, that was much later. So, yeah, I mean, I think he was pretty well known as a pitcher, right? Mm-hmm. Isn't that what he was saying? He was a pitcher. And yeah, he did an episode of The Brady Bunch, and he did an episode of The Flying Nun, and he plays himself in all of these things.
All right. So this is who Jeff, the son, is going to interview, but he's got some time to kill, right? He's got a buddy on this show, just like Wally, Beaver's friend, Beaver's brother, has a buddy. All these people look exactly the same.
Can right. we just they all say have the same right haircut. Now? They're like white dudes.
Every single person, like every teenager on this show is, yes, it goes without saying that they're all white. There's no ethnic diversity whatsoever. And then they give all of them the same exact haircut.
Right. And this guy's
boys'
name
haircut,
is
girls' haircut.
Smitty. Right. Well, the girls, though, at least there's like a blonde and a brunette, so you can tell the difference between Angie and Marcia.
I struggle. Yeah. So Smitty says, and I quote, "You want to get some laughs? Let's go watch the girls play softball."
That's right. And this is where Jeff is like, hey, you know, watching the girls is fun. They can play. Like, don't be so mean. You know, he kind of is like, he's the more upstanding guy. Like, if his mom thinks he's rude, boy, she should hear his friend.
Yeah. And the whole notion of girls in sports and stuff is going to figure large in this episode, but not necessarily from the point of view of like, you know, like we don't take them seriously as athletes. I think Smitty is in that camp. I think for a lot of the other people, it's going to be about the conflicts of interests that arise from this.
Yeah, look, the girls are taking themselves seriously, despite the fact that their team names are the Glamourettes and the Starlets.
Yeah, we go to the softball game. Now, I want to point out here, I think this is a first for our sitcom study podcast. We only have one show this week that even pretends to be shot in front of a studio audience that even has any laughter, be it real or canned at all. All three of the other ones are single camera, shooting around town, whatever. So this is like we talked about with Leave It to Beaver and the Munsters and whatnot. They're just picking up the camera and going either to a real softball field or a set or whatever. But it is, I just noticed immediately, like, oh, this isn't like those other old sitcoms. There's none of the canned laughter or whatever. But yeah, at this ball game, the dilemma is they don't have an umpire, right?
Right.
We have these
well,
two girls.
Not at this game. That's their game later on, right?
Okay, but they're discussing that.
Yeah, they're discussing that. I guess they're like having a scrimmage or something because they're going to play the next day. And they're like, hey, who's going to end up umpiring? And I just want to note that this isn't softball. Like, the ball is a baseball. This is baseball. I don't know
but
when.
But they're pitching like, it like a softball.
They're just throwing underhanded, which you're allowed to do in baseball as well. You can throw whatever way. The difference between softball and baseball, though, I believe is the size of the ball. So anyway, yeah, they're having this argument. Well, not really argument, but they just want to find somebody fair. And they're both the team captains, Angie and Marcia, who are the two girls that Jeff was kind of hoping might ask him to the dance. And so he shows up and they both are like, oh, you know, nice to see you. Oh, are you coming to the game tomorrow? And who do you think's going to win? And his friend starts giving him a hard time. He's like, how are you going to answer this one? You're never going to get out of this.
Well, what they ask him is, who are you beating for? Which I noticed that that's what they say instead of rooting for. They have their own terminology for it.
Right. So anyway, so he says he makes a joke to his friend and is like, don't you worry. Watch, I got this. And he says, you know, with two great teams and two such captains as yourselves, whoever, no matter what, whoever wins, it's going to be a great game.
Yeah, he's a diplomat.
That's right. And the girls are like, oh, and then they walk away and they have a little side conversation. And then they do the like shoot the numbers, rock, paper, scissors to see who's going to go back and talk to him. And Angie comes back over and she butters him up and she's like, oh, we're so excited to have you and all the girls love that you're here. And I have something very important to ask you. And he's like, oh, yeah, she's going to ask me to the dance. And she says, we just agreed that we'd love you to be the umpire tomorrow. And he's like, oh, well, sure. Sure. And then kind of says yes without even thinking about it and is bummed that he didn't get asked to the party or whatever. And so then off he goes. Doesn't think anything more about it except for that he was bummed that he didn't get asked to the party. And then the next scene is him back at home on a tirade in the kitchen with his sister because when he went to go to the interview, Don Drysdale never showed up.
Yes, he's been stood up by Don Drysdale. So just quickly in terms of tracking the trope, we can see how this thing of the Sadie Hawkins dance sort of functions as like the incentive.
Right.
You know, like this is this thing, just sort of this context hanging over the episode that that's why, you know, he wants to be in good with the girls, basically.
Right.
And that's, you know, essentially the only function. So it's worth mentioning. And then, yeah, Jeff is talking to his sister about how mad he is or how sore he is. I love in these old-timey shows when they use the word sore. He's sore at Don Drysdale for having stood him up. He's yelling, you know, he's pacing around the kitchen going on and on about how the great Drysdale couldn't bother to tell me he'd be late or didn't come.
He's not even a pitcher. He couldn't pitch his way out of him. And he's like running him down all the while. Don Drysdale is in the backyard talking to the dad because he has come over because he realized that he missed his appointment and he felt bad. And so he's having this conversation with the dad in the backyard and, of course, overhears this ranting in the kitchen.
Yeah, like we said, this guy's acting is very subdued. He's got the energy of Denise Huxtable in the A Different World episode. He's just very low key and he's telling the dad, he's out back with the dad telling him, you know, I was supposed to meet with your son for an interview, but I couldn't come. So I thought I'd come down here and explain it. And so, yeah, you know, he's saying this and then they're hearing the kid yelling from inside. And then eventually they're like, all right, let's go in and straighten this out. Now, there's a ruse here that Don Drysdale pulls off. This took me a beat to get. Like, I was confused by this whole thing for a while. So why don't you explain how this plays out?
Okay, so Jeff turns around in the kitchen, sees out the window that Don Drysdale is out there and is like, oh my God, he had to have heard me. Oh no, oh no. And tries to run out of the kitchen and his sister's like pulling on his suit jacket, like not letting him leave. He weasels out of his suit jacket and is trying to run and hide. And the dad and Don Drysdale come in from another door into the living room, kind of where Jeff is trying to escape. And he gets caught and he's like, oh, hi, Don Drysdale. Wow, what are you doing here? And Don pretends like he can't hear. He says, oh, sorry, can you speak up? I'm having a little bit of trouble hearing. Must be the altitude, because he has traveled from LA to wherever they are in whatever city. And so he's like, I'm having a hard time hearing. So then we have, you know, a little bit of an exchange where like the characters are talking louder and he asks a few times. And then the dad says, come on, sister, I forget her name, let's go in the other room so we can leave them to their interview. And as they're walking out of the room and they're far enough away that he shouldn't be able to hear her when she speaks in sotto voice, she says to the dad, wow, isn't he a looker or something like that. And Don Drysdale goes, thanks. And then Jeff is like, oh no, he can hear. And everyone's like, oh no. And then this is the only bit of good acting he does in the whole thing.
Yeah.
He tugs on his ear and he goes, look at that. They just popped.
So what's happening is Drysdale has decided, oh, I'll spare him the embarrassment and pretend that my hearing was messed up so I couldn't hear his little tirade about how angry he was. I was watching this at first going like, oh, Drysdale is so mad. He's like big dogging him. He's like doing mind games where he's pretending he can't hear and making him say everything twice just to like get under his skin. Like, I did not follow this.
You're
complex,
like way too cynical, like for the 50s and 60s where we are.
Well, it's more that the show is so, the way it plays it is just a little bit different. Not that it's really that hard to understand, but yeah, I don't know. It took me a beat. But so ultimately, they do the interview.
Right.
You know, and he gets his little, you know, school paper type interview. And at the end, Jeff mentions to Drysdale, Don Drysdale, he says, oh, I'm going to umpire a local ball game. He says, oh, you know, who are the fellas that you're going to umpire? Whatever. He goes, oh, well, you know, actually, they're not fellas. It's the girls' teams. And just like everyone else, he reacts to this news like he was saying he was going to umpire, I don't know, like a ball game between Charles Manson and Leatherface or something. He's just like, what the hell are you doing?
Yeah, don't do that. Girls are the worst, is basically how he reacts.
Yeah, and it is wild. I mean, he does like essentially a spit take. And I guess it's supposed to be, like I said before, it's not so much like women playing sports, gross. It's more like, oh, to be the umpire, like, oh boy, you're going to have to, you know, you're going to have to hurt their feelings or make decisions or make choices. Like it's sort of like that, right?
This idea. See, I was, maybe that's what it's supposed to be. I was taking it as girls are mean. And when they get mad and they get stubborn, like they will yell at you.
Well,
and
I think it's
going to be way worse than any regular like ball game with boys that you've ever seen.
Yeah, that's kind of what I mean. Yeah. All the same thing, that just being in that position is going to be hard.
Right.
And then, yeah, when he mentions it to his dad and goes on his way, there's a point where the dad says to the sister, I wouldn't be in Jeff's shoes for all the tea in China.
Right.
So it is just really hammering home the last thing you ever want to do is umpire a girl's baseball game. But these are the things you do when it's almost Sadie Hawkins Day, right? And you got to get in good.
There you go. So off he goes to umpire the game, and he's getting all set up in his umpire padding.
Gigantic.
Yes. This like huge kind of spade-shaped pad or heart-shaped pad that he's wearing.
In the 60s, you don't wear the umpire pads. The umpire pads wear you.
That's very true. That's what it looks like. And so Marcia comes over and is like, oh, you're so big and strong. Let me help you with this pad. Let me see. Are you all set? Does that feel comfortable? Like she's trying to butter him up for her team. And then Angie comes over and she's like, I'm going to feel so safe with a man like you is behind me when I'm catching. I'll just know that I'm always going to be protected, you know. And they're all trying to, like, you know, she's trying to butter him up for her team, and so they're giving each other dirty looks like, don't you try to butter him up. No, don't you try to butter him up.
Yes. And then he proceeds to be the worst umpire the sport of baseball has ever known. Right. And I am not a big baseball guy, but they start this thing and even I can tell, all right, the first thing, she swings and misses, but the pitch is way too high, right? And so he calls it a ball. And, you know, they start bickering. He says, oh, that was a swing. He says, no, the ball was too high. So I'm watching this going, okay. I get what he's doing.
Right. And then the other girl goes, yeah, but she was crouching.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, oh, that's true. You were crouching. Like he was going to change his mind.
But he doesn't.
And then the other girl is like, seriously, this isn't a discussion. He called it a ball. It's a ball. Let's go.
Yes. And then the second play is a strike, but she like hesitates. And so after the girl, you know, after he calls it a strike and the girl goes, oh, no, I didn't swing. And he goes like, well, it was kind of a half swing. And at that moment, I'm like, oh, it's over for you, buddy. Like,
yeah.
You have lost all credibility.
He's trying to like reason with them. And there is no reasoning with them. Right. So that we get through that kind of hard scene, you know,
Well, he starts doing things like, you know, oh, let's do it over again.
Yeah,
like
he just
veers off of how any real baseball game could go.
Right. So we get out of that inning and then he goes over to get a drink of water and Marcia doesn't want to talk to him. And so Don Drysdale turns out, oh, look, he's shown up at the game. So he goes over to have a quick conversation.
Well, do you know why he's shown up? Because Don Drysdale is the most conscientious celebrity of any kind that I've ever seen. He shows up after having personally reported to this kid's house to do the makeup school newspaper interview that he missed earlier that day. He then shows up at the baseball game to return his pen.
That's right. Well, you know what? people were more polite in the 60s.
Yeah, yeah. So, and pens, God. I mean,
yeah,
I mean, they don't grow on trees.
Exactly. Those are expensive. It's had to have been a fountain pen. So anyway, so he returns his pen and he says, hey, look, nobody argues with the umpire. A good, like, what did he say? A wrong decision is better than no decision.
Very sketchy advice from Don Drysdale. I would say that in sports, fine, but he's specifically trying to make this a life lesson.
A life lesson, he's saying, and it is not.
Yeah, he's saying in sports as well as in life, you need to stick to your
guns.
A wrong
decision is better than no decision, and be firm.
Yes, which I was taken aback by that. Like, it's one thing to say, as an umpire or a ref, once you've made the call, that's just the way the game works. It's another thing to say, in life,
right,
think things through as quickly as possible, make a snap decision, and whatever you do, don't rethink it.
That's right. Don't waver, because that's bad. So he gives him this advice, and it actually does work as umpire, because he's like, from then on, he's like, my decision stands. I'm not arguing. I called it this. This is what it is.
And the ladies respond to that tone.
They do. They all are like, okay. I mean, they're annoyed if they huff and puff and they go away and they don't try to convince him once he's made his decision. So the end of the game, we have a couple more scenes where it's like, you know, big calls. Like, one was a foul ball. Mm-hmm. One was like this random scene where the ball got stuck inside. Like, it bounced into a garbage can, and inside the garbage can got stuck inside a tin can.
Yeah.
And then they couldn't get it out of the tin can, so they threw the tin can back to home plate and tagged her with the tin can instead of with the ball. And so there was this big hubbaloo, you know, about
there's
that.
There's a lot of softball, or baseball, rather. I wrote, this is reminiscent of Sleepaway Camp, the 80s horror movie that famously has like 25 minutes of softball game in the middle of the thing just to pad out the movie. It kind of feels like that.
Right. So everything is good. Game is over. He's kind of, you know, he's gone home. He's like, whatever. I know every girl in school is mad at me. It's fine. It is what it is. I had to do what I had to do to be the umpire. So I've just given up. Nobody's going to go to the Sadie Hawkins, you know, party with me. Nobody's going to ask me. And then ding dong, here comes Angie. And she's like, wow, all the girls were so impressed by how firm you were today. I want to know if you want to go to the Sadie Hawkins party with me. And he was like, and before he can even answer, ding dong, doorbell rings again, over he goes, and Marcia walks in, and she doesn't waste any time, and she doesn't see Angie, and she says, wow, what a great game. Thanks for that. I just came over to see if you want to go to the Sadie Hawkins party. And he's like, well, and then Angie walks into frame and they're like, what are you doing here? Well, what are you doing here? Well, who are you going to go with? Who are you going to go with? And so he has to go back into his umpire mode. And he's like, you know what? Angie asked me first. Fair is fair. I'm going with her. And Marcia's like, okay, I accept it. Fair is fair. Off she leaves.
Also, the two of you are exactly identical, so there's they no look meaningful
nothing
way to
alike.
Distinguish
you. One is tall, one is short, one is blonde, one has brown hair.
So yeah, so he's got a first come, first serve policy with the ladies, and so he makes his decision, he sticks to it. He'd be fine if not for he has to quote his buddy Don Drysdale and say, yeah, the lesson I learned this week was it's better to have a wrong decision than no decision at all. Puts his foot in his mouth, and the girl is like, what do you mean the wrong decision?
That's right. And you don't have to go with me. And then Angie storms out. So now he's left with no date again.
Yeah. So look, in terms of the Sadie Hawkins of it all, like I said, you know, I guess if you're back in this time, this is just a thing that would happen. Like, oh, hey, it's Sadie Hawkins Day. So just the same way and Saved by the Bell, you know, they would just sort of casually be like, oh, that school dance is coming up. Guess I need to find a date just to kind of kickstart the plot. That's what they're doing here.
Yeah. Well, and I want to make note that this whole scene here at the end directly ties back to the beginning. It's if he stuck his foot in his mouth because he doesn't think before he speaks when he's talking to girls, just like his mom warned him about at the very beginning of the episode.
No, it's true. It's his sociopath tendencies that tend to trip him up. All right, moving on to Punky Brewster.
Season 3, episode 16, This Spud's for You.
Yeah, so we talked about Punky before with our Dreams episode. You were into this as a kid, and I was not really familiar with it. I'm starting to realize I need to adjust my expectations a little bit. I think I thought of Punky Brewster as being along the lines of a Different Strokes, maybe, but I feel like Different Strokes is like The Sopranos compared to Punky Brewster.
No, like, Punky Brewster is like a Saturday morning kind of show.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. It is very young in its whole sort of tone, and like just it's very strange in a way that is fun, but I need to kind of like click into it. There's a lot of weird choices they make with the music and stuff, like we talked about last time, and just it's just a strange show, and the way the people behave is strange, and it just the whole thing is just kind of like a bizarre beast.
Look, I think of Punky and Silver Spoons and all of those kinds of shows in the same vein that I think of Saved by the Bell, right? There are these not, they were not primetime sitcoms. Yeah. They were meant for kids. They weren't on Nickelodeon. They were just the 80s kids kind of sitcoms that we watched when mom and dad were making dinner or when it was morning time on Saturday morning and we got up early, you know, kind of a thing. And so, this one, yet again, we have the random elementary school dance.
Yeah, this girl cannot catch a break with the creepers hassling her. I mean,
so
the
last what we got last time too, right?
Yeah, we talked about this show. We had young Ricky Schroeder playing this, you know, little Brett Kavanaugh type that was hassling her at school. This time we get the kid who plays Horace in the Monster Squad.
Nice, playing, good pull. I'd never seen that kid before.
Oh, yeah. No, he's instantly recognizable if you remember that movie. And I really feel for this kid, the real life actor. In the Monster Squad, as I said, his character's name is Horace, but they call him Fat Kid. That's right. His nickname in the movie. And in this, his nickname is Spud, but the crack writing team at Punky Brewster writes him lines like, "Oh, thanks, I'll eat this on my way to dinner."
Right.
You know, so just his whole character is, I'm a fat kid.
Yes.
I eat all the time.
Well, and his room, did you notice the set decoration in his room?
Well, you mean his environment.
That's right. He calls it his environment because I can't be one to throw stones. He's got clothes all over the floor, and I do the same thing. I'm the worst. But the decor in his environment on the walls, instead of posters of celebrities or cars or, you know, bands or whatever, no, he has posters of butter, ice cream, and cheese.
I did not notice that. But it's one thing to be like, you know, hey, I'm a character actor and this is my thing. I'm going to play the funny fat guys and I'm going to just, you know, have a sense of humor about it and make that. But you're like an 8-year-old kid and your parents are telling you like, okay, honey, you know, we've found this listing for, you know, kid that covers his room in banana posters. We think you'd be good for it. Like, oh boy. Of course, this character's other attribute is he is in love with Punky. That's going to be a thing because, once again, it's Sadie Hawkins Day and he's in the market for an invite.
That's right. So not only do we get the amazing writing for the little fat kid, but we start off the show with Henry, Punky's adoptive father, making fat jokes at Cherry's mom's expense, telling her she can't have a burger because she eats too much and she should have sushi instead. And she's like, gross, I don't eat raw fish. I'm out of here. And she goes off to go find something else to eat.
Yes. In the 80s, we as a culture were mystified by sushi. This was definitely a thing in the 80s and early 90s as the Japanese culture was starting to come over, right? You had this thing of, oh my God, raw fish. And it is funny to watch that stuff now because it's like now sushi is a food.
Yeah, sushi is like getting French fries.
Yeah, it's like going, oh my God, you're eating General Tso's chicken? Gross. Like it's just a thing that you get at certain restaurants. But yeah, they're doing the sushi jokes, all that stuff. Yeah, like you said, Henry makes the joke, it's time you've broadened your culinary horizons. You've broadened everything else. So,
oh boy.
Yeah, and then Horace from Monster Squad shows up, Spud, and we get the whole premise. You know, right. Sadie Hawkins' dance is coming. He wants her to ask him. She doesn't want to.
She's not interested. Cherry's like, well, you said we could double date. Once again, Cherry has a date. Punky's not interested in dating. She's like, I know, peer pressured. So Spud's like, you know what? I have a great friend named Farley. I think he'll be just right for you. But hold on, let me go get him on the phone. And Punky's like, there's a phone right here. He's like, no, he's a little shy. I got to talk to him in the other room first. So he goes into the kitchen, picks up the receiver in the kitchen. This is brilliant. I don't know why I never thought of doing something like this. He calls his mom. He says, hey, mom, go down to the basement or the laundry room or something. I left my whatever there. And, you know, I'll wait here on the phone while she goes down to run that errand. So then he's on the phone and he goes, okay, Punky, he's ready. You can pick up. She picks up the phone in the other room and he covers it with a handkerchief and is now the line is open. You wouldn't just hear the dial tone.
I feel
tone.
Like this is something we need to explain to anyone who's younger than like 25 years old. In the days of landline, if you picked up multiple phones in the same house, you would all be connected
right,
and it would sound just like you were on the phone with someone else.
But it wouldn't work if there wasn't already a call out. Like if I got on the phone and you got in the kitchen and you got on
you
the phone
hear
and you'd hear the dial tone and both of you would hear the dial tone. You wouldn't be able to talk to one another. So he had to make the call out, have his mom put the phone down so then it sounded like he was talking to her from somewhere else.
This is that, like, Ethan Hunt level espionage.
Blew my mind as a kid who never, like, I mean, you know, we're that weird generation that only had those analog phones kind of a thing, like only had those landlines until about college. So anyway, I was just like, what? This is crazy. This kid's so smart. Oh my gosh. So anyway, he does this.
Not that smart.
So he does this and Punky's on the phone and she's like all, you know, girl talky, like, oh, he sounds so cute. Do you want to maybe go to the dance with me?
Did you mention that the what Farley has going for him is he can get tickets to any concert in town?
Oh,
for
that's
free.
Right. That's why right? she wants
He's
to
constructed,
be.
He's constructed this whole fake identity that, you know, once again, I'll quote my little girlfriend from Blackish, a plan that comes pre-ruined.
That's right.
Right. This Farley character that does not exist and cannot get tickets. But this is, I guess, all just to get her to say yes on the phone. And, you know, his plan is when I show up as myself and she sees Farley as me, we'll jump off that bridge when we get
to it. It'll be too late and she'll have to go with me, right? So Cherry starts to, like, get suspicious because she hears something in the kitchen.
Yeah, Cherry's Punky's friend.
Right. So she goes over and opens the bottom of the half door and we see Spud squatting down, talking into the phone, and Punky comes running over and she's like, you slimy rodent!
Yes, this is another sitcom just like Alf where the kitchen living room window door situation perfectly fits the needs of the blocking of the scene, that they have this double door thing that has like a separate upper and lower half so you can open the top half and it's kind of like a window, or open both halves and it's a door. But yeah, it all falls apart because they spot him. The jig is up. I think it's kind of funny that his name is Farley. You know, he says, oh, this mystery man, his name is Farley. It turns out that that's his name and
his
they just
name.
Didn't know that. But just by coincidence, that happens to be the name of the most famous fat person that ever lived.
Well,
or
and
one
we
of
also
them.
Get a Farley in the next episode. We get a Farley in Parker Lewis as well. I was like, whoa, so many Farleys.
Weird coincidences. But the jig is up. Punky gets very, very angry. And so...
All right. So we get some great Punky face in this episode.
Yes, definitely.
Like many times throughout the episode. They do a little chase scene around the table in the kitchen. And Farley / Spud is throwing chairs in front of her. And she's knocking him out of the way and chasing after him.
Yeah. I feel like for me, the jury is very much out on whether or not she is a good actress, quote unquote. But she definitely has this way about her where, first of all, she sounds like she smokes 3 packs of cigarettes a day to get that voice.
She does have this kind of gravelly little voice.
Yeah, like, you know, we talked last time about how she really kind of goes all in on the emotions. in this sort of like Shirley Temple way.
Yeah, it's
which can
very
be,
like kid actory, yeah, for sure.
So it's not necessarily like super persuasive or realistic, but sometimes it can be hilarious. Like when Farley goes, oh, hey, tell me what kind of flowers do you like for the dance? And she's like stiff as a board, glaring at him. And she sounds like Regan from The Exorcist. She goes, daisies with you pushing them up. It is amazing.
It's really funny. And that is a line that goes to commercial, which is great because it should, because it's so cute. And then we get Henry and Punky have their heart to heart, right? About, you know, he tricked me and I don't really want to go with him. But now he says I have to because I asked him, but I don't think it wasn't a real ask. I didn't ask him. I asked somebody else or who I thought was somebody else. And Henry's like, you know you'll do the right thing. Doesn't really give her any guidance, just kind of lets her go on with it. So then she goes over to his apartment to have a conversation with him. And this is where we see the welcome to my environment.
Yes,
there's candy hanging in the closet. There's a sign on his door that says a bratty kid lives here. I mean, like, there's cake on a shelf. Like, every place that would normally have books has food. Or clothes, the places where there would normally be clothes, there's food.
Yeah. He says, welcome to my environment. It's hilarious. So she goes in, talks to him for a while, and then he goes out the window.
Yeah, well, so Cherry's with her.
Yeah.
And she tells him, it wasn't fair the way you tricked me. I wouldn't have asked you. And I'm not going to go with you. And he's like, no, you can't do that. If you're not going to go to the dance with me, then I'm going to jump out this window. And now we get a nice little overlapping trope,
yes,
right?
This is an overlapping trope. Lots of sitcoms had jumpers, right? People on the ledge that had to be talked down.
If you do this, I'm going to jump.
Right. This is a trope that I am not particularly in favor of covering because having known multiple people who died by suicide, it's kind of a bummer.
Yes.
But this episode embraces this concept wholeheartedly and it is demented.
I would say, we should say though that most of the time when these episodes do cover this, it's not in the serious way at all. It's always in the like over the top, over dramatic. I'm trying to get what I want to get out of it.
Right. This one does all of the above.
Yeah.
This is going for silliness and sitcom goofery and also like serious action movie suspense. It is just, to me, a wild miscalculation to show me two children on the ledge of a building and be making jokes and it's supposed to be funny. Like, I just found this absolutely crazy.
Yeah. Well, so look, I immediately was like, I don't like that, right? I don't think it's not okay in any situation to threaten another person with your own death.
Yeah.
Because you're not getting what you want. I'm like, game over, Spud. You're a bad person. Like, done. You need help. You're messed up. Well, so he goes out the window and his little 8-year-old, 9-year-old self goes out the window and he's like, that's it. I'm not coming back in. We get Cherry and Punky peeking out the window and they're like, what are you doing? And he's like, I told everybody at school that you were coming with me. I can't go back now. That's it. It's over for me. If you don't go to the dance, it's over. I don't even want to live anymore. And he goes to take a step to the edge and then realizes what he's doing and is like, no. And then is like, oh my God, get me inside. I want to come inside. Come out here and get me. Help me. And it turns. So now he's realized that he's made this stupid ass mistake, but he's like, Punky, I can't do it by myself. You have to come out here and get me. You have to come help me.
Yes, which first of all, what the hell does he expect her to do? You got to just go back in there. But also, Punky's problem solving is faulty here too. She's supposed to be a savvy kid. She should come up with a better solution than going out onto the ledge herself.
Right.
If he really needs help, yeah, take the bed sheet or something to grab onto to help, you know, you feel a little more safe. But no, she goes on the ledge as well. And even somehow decides to like cross over him.
Oh my gosh, that's the scariest thing, right? Yeah. So she goes out on the ledge. Cherry says, I'm going to go and get some help. And first I'm going to move my bike because you guys are going to splat on my bike. And so we get this little funny joke about the bike that kind of recurs a few times now. So she goes to get help and Punky's out on the ledge. And then part of the ledge that is between them and the window breaks and falls off.
Yeah.
So they can't get back to the window. And Punky's like, all right, what's the other way in? And he's like, on the other side of the nose. And then the camera zooms out and we see that like on the side of this building is this big old billboard for an optician. And it's got a big nose and glasses and eyes looking back and forth. Yeah. And the other window.
That standard thing that's on every
totally.
Building.
You know, just a random billboard on the building. That so the other window is on the other side of that window on the other side of that billboard. So he's like, around the nose is the only way. And he's like, and she's like, all right, well, I'll follow you because he's closer. And he says, no, you first. Who's saving who here? Like guilting her into doing it because he's a horrible person. And she's like, oh my god, okay, well. And he's and she's like, but I can't get around your belly. And he's like, well, I'll suck it in. And then she's like, ha ha, are you sucking it in yet? And then he said, and then he's like, yeah, I'm doing as best I can or whatever. And she goes, okay, I'm going to hold on to your belt and
yes.
swing around you.
Yes.
Now, if this
Insane.
Was real people and she held on to his belt, then they would both fall
that
off.
That is a surefire way to kill you.
You yes. both fall
that
off.
That is mission accomplished. We are dead.
Now you're both dead. But so she hangs on to his belt, swings herself around. I'm like, what is going on? And he goes, well, did my belt break? And she goes, belts don't break, they're leather. And he goes, they do when they're cardboard. And she's like, what? And he's like, yeah, I couldn't find a belt that fit, so my belt is cardboard. On cue, boom, his pants fall down.
Yeah. Now, we just have to emphasize the whole time, like, there, this is played, there's music going on, this sort of like, you know, intense but cheesy synthy suspense music and everything. This is played as like, yes, this is a dangerous situation. And yet not at all is this a very special episode. Like the magnitude, the gravity, no pun intended, of like the whole notion of suicide or the death of a child is just not acknowledged. The audience, I don't know if it's a real or fake audience in this one, is laughing every time one of these little gags happen.
Yes.
And again, like that's all I'll say about it, because I don't want to be like taking it too seriously,
right.
But it is funny how in the 80s, there really was this thing of like, he's a jumper. Jumper.
That's funny.
Get off the ledge, buddy. You know,
yeah.
Like it. And
well,
even with children.
Well, and look, Punky, this is season 4. Earlier seasons, we got some very, like, very special episodes after school, specially like dealing with, you know, adoption and dealing with the Challenger explosion, dealing with one of my favorite episodes of Punky Brewster that we must cover. Don't get inside an abandoned refrigerator.
Okay.
But this is not one of those episodes. This is a very silly episode that is still talking about suicide, but not really talking about suicide. Basically just saying this kid made a dumb decision and it's not about suicide at all.
Yeah, it's played
so
like if he ran away
like,
from home.
Right. Now we're in this situation and the situation is comical, right? Well, comical and scary. So she gets around to the other side of him. His pants fall down. He's like, you have to pick up my pants. Give me some of my dignity. If I'm going to die, I want to have my pants on. Well, they're not going to stay up, you dumbass, because your belt's made of cardboard, but whatever. So she leans down, pulls up his pants, and the way he helps her back up is by pulling on her hair at the top of her head.
Yep.
And I'm like, what is
what
even
else would
happening?
He do?
What is even
How
happening
else
in the show right
do?
Now? So his pants come up and then they start moving toward the nose. The minute he takes one step, of course, they fall down again. She's like, okay, follow me. She grabs onto one of the glasses. She puts her leg up on the nostril, like it's got like flared nostrils.
Yeah, this
nose.
Is like that Nickelodeon show where
right.
you would have to scale the big nose. Or
something. Like dig up inside it on Double Dare.
Yeah.
So she kind of straddles. She gets herself straddling the nose. She's holding onto the glasses, and she's like, okay, all right. And then we get a little funny moment where her head goes back and forth with the eyeballs in time.
Yeah.
And then she's like, I think we're going to be okay. Dun, dun. And the glasses break loose and start slipping down the nose.
Yeah.
And that's it. Like, the kid, the Spud is screaming, we're going to die. Punky's dangling on the edge of this nose. Like, we're going to die.
You hear children say the phrase, we are going to die in this episode is wild. Yeah, and then it ends with a whimper. Like, they don't resolve the situation, right? She's dangling. The glasses slide down the nose incrementally. Like, they're attached by a wire, but they keep getting looser and falling down further. And she's dangling, you know, presumably off this fifth-story ledge. And then it's just like...
It goes to commercial, and when we come back from commercial, the fireman has rescued them. They're back in Spud's apartment, in his environment, and the... fireman is like, you guys don't go out on ledges, and says to Cherry, thank you so much for giving us good directions and helping us get here. And, you know, and so that's the end of the scary part, right? Now all we have left to tie up is, are they going to go to the dance together?
Yeah. And they have another little heart to heart. You know, Punky says, I want to spend a minute alone with Spud Farley. And this is where the show decides to get serious. Not the kid threatening to kill himself. That's going to be a barrel of laughs.
That's comedy gold, now, Jay.
Now we get into this serious, intimate moment where Farley unveils his Spud Loves Punky poster that was hidden behind one of his, like, Banana Splits posters or something. And he basically says, yeah, this is straight out of the playbook of Urkel and Screech and all of these unrequited nerdy lovers. They're just like, that's my thing. I love you. Like, this is my whole thing, is that I want you to be my girlfriend, go with me to the dance, whatever. And he wears her down. Right.
And Punky's like, fine. And he goes, great. And then we'll go to honeymoon in Barbados. And she's like, watch it, Spud.
Yeah. So look, there's not time enough to get into the, you know, crazy politics of, like I said, this other recurring mega trope of these guys that can't take no for an answer. But yes, this is very much, you know, the junior version of that thing. The girl kind of rolling her eyes and go, okay, I guess I'll do it. I guess I'll go to the thing because you're not such a bad guy after all. Yeah, it's kind of a bummer that through all of this, what we don't get is any sort of like, hey, I like you even though you're overweight. Like, right. That's not a thing.
No, this is definitely not a like Alex from Taxi blind date kind
of
thing. No, not at all. But look, so one of the premises of our show is we think about what we learned from these episodes, right? Do you think young boys, maybe girls too, learned that this is an appropriate way to get what you want?
Absolutely. I think that I absorbed so much stuff from shows like this. And in fact, I could even say from personal experience, I quote unquote ran away from home at one point. Like, I went, you know, down the street or something when I was a little kid because I was mad at my family. And that was definitely something I got from some TV show or movie or something. And so, yeah, luckily, you know, I think most kids, by the time they're old enough to even be watching something like this, they have the sensibility to not take
frontal
to the window
lobe
ledge.
Has developed a little bit more.
But yeah, totally. These shows definitely implant these notions, even if it's mostly a joke of like, this is a thing that happens, or this is a thing that some people do. And yeah, it's not great. I don't think it helped anybody.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, look, I love Punky Brewster. I don't remember this episode, but yeah, it is kind of a bummer to go back to this. And I think probably as a kid, I would have laughed at this if I did see this one. I don't remember, but you know, I probably would have thought this was really funny because they were trying to make the character of Spud out in a way that he is nobody. Like, he's not an actual person. He's just like a cartoon that you can laugh at. And that's, I think, why they felt like they could maybe get away with something like this. But yeah, it is kind of a bummer to look back on it in several ways and be like,
But in terms of tracking the trope, again, we get the idea that in the 80s, it's still very much a thing that you can go like, oh, Sadie Hawkins Day is coming up. And that means, you know, the boys are going to have a reason to try to get the girls to like them or do something.
Well, and this is Sadie Hawkins episode number 2 that is really about the boy, not the girl, even though it's supposed to be about a day of female empowerment.
Let's see how this continues with Parker Lewis.
He Can't Lose, season 1, episode 6, Gag Dance.
Yeah, so we talked about Parker Lewis back in our class president elections episode.
Right.
This is one of many characters or phenomena that are inspired by Ferris Bueller. You know, we talked then about how you really could not overstate the impact of that movie. This was one of the most clear imitators, but you see it trickling down from your Zach Morris's into even your Sabrina's and stuff. That whole thing of talking to the camera and sort of having the whole thing figured out and having cool high-tech gadgets and just kind of being super popular, but also just kind of like getting the better of everybody.
Right.
And those characters like Ferris Bueller and Zach Morris have sort of had this reckoning in recent years, where you get all the think pieces about like, wait a minute, Ferris Bueller is a psychopath, or was Zach Morris kind of a garbage person? And, you know,
well, Zach Morris was a garbage person from jump. What?
Well, yes. But that's the thing, is that in the 80s and 90s, it was just so alluring, I think, to live vicariously through these characters, and the privilege, like the sheer privilege of it all, was just sort of entertaining and intoxicating, I think. And where I was going with this was to say, Parker Lewis, I feel like, doesn't get as much of that because his cultural impact is smaller, but to me, he's got the shortest walk to like, oh yeah, this guy is just a villain. You know, like this actor, Corin Nemec, has this sort of like Fire Marshal Bill look to him with the weird intense stares and the dimples and the weird smile and everything. And the way he's always sort of pulling the strings, and every storyline is like, he has some goal that he's going to stop at nothing to achieve. And like this more than any of those other characters, I watch now and go like, oh, we are watching from the point of view of the villain.
Like the villain origin story.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting, because in this episode, I felt like his insecurities were showing in ways that I don't think is true in the other episodes of this show. Mm. In this one, there's, you know, same premise, right? There's going to be a girls ask guys dance in a couple of weeks, and everybody, all the boys, are excited or terrified because the girls are going around with these stickers and tagging the boys. They're getting gag tagged.
Right. It's worth noting we're in the 90s now, and not that Sadie Hawkins has completely gone away, but this one doesn't use that term at all, right? This is the gag dance. That's girls right. ask guys.
Yes.
And so, yeah, they have their gag. Are they hearts?
Tags. They're hearts.
Yeah.
And they're like either stickers or pins or whatever, and they stick them on the guy that they're going to ask.
So gag, you're it.
That's right. And then they say, you've been gag tagged. And mm-hmm. that's what that it means, that you are already going to the dance with somebody. So everybody is like, we find at the beginning, Parker Lewis is hiding from all the girls because there's only one girl he wants to ask him. And then his friend is trying to like put himself in the path of this other girl over and over again because he really wants that girl to ask him. And then his other friend, the one that calls them Sir,
Jerry,
he's hiding in lockers because there's a girl that likes him that he doesn't like, so he doesn't want to get tagged either. So they're all like, everybody's kind of half the guys are hiding, half the guys are all excited because the girl they wanted asked them.
I feel like that's a subtrope too, the thing of like, if you're a popular guy that the girls like or vice versa, like hiding until the person that you want to ask you has access to you.
Right. So anyway, so I think, like I was saying, in this episode, though, the arc of it is like he really wants this one girl to ask him, and she keeps demurring, like at every turn, and then kind of, you know, all his shenanigans, we'll talk about those, but she ends up asking somebody else, right, after all of his shenanigans, and then we see him have this, like, moment of reckoning, like, I don't want to hurt her feelings. I don't want to ruin, like, she looks happy with this guy. So normally, in a normal episode of Parker Lewis, right, he would have some whole master plan of how he was going to, like, trip her up this way. And we're going, but he actually is like, oh, she looks really happy with him, even though it's a bad relationship. I guess I'll just leave it alone because I don't want to make her sad. And I was like, oh, okay, we're getting to see a little softer side. And so he's just like, all right, well, I'm not going to go to the dance because I don't want to ruin it for her if she's happy, even though it's a horrible relationship.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't remember the show well enough to really make the case, but I feel like this arc of Parker has a goal and he does this elaborate scheme to make it happen. And then there's some either unintended consequence or collateral damage or something that causes this sort of crisis of conscience or confidence or whatever. And then the second half of the episode is him being more sincere.
Right.
You know, I feel like that was a thing that happened
in that last episode too. Yeah. You're right. You're right.
Well, let's slow it down a little because the players here, there's a lot to talk about. So this girl that he is interested in is Tracy Lee Summers. That's the character.
Now, it's Blake Lively's sister.
Right. Robin Lively, right?
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
I know her as the love interest in The Karate Kid Part 3.
Hey!
And by love interest, I mean friendship interest, because they decided in that one, they didn't want Ralph Macchio to be like James Bond, like to be going through women, you know, like every 6 months. So that's one of the only movies of that kind and in that time where she's there to just be friends.
Nice.
But she's in that and she's Teen Witch.
Okay, well, I recognized her as this young actress, you know, when she was younger. And I was like, oh, yeah, she does look familiar. She was in a ton of stuff. But we've already seen her on the podcast once. She was one of the grown-ups at the 30 Rock reunion episode.
It was not where I thought you were going.
Uh-huh. She's wearing a blonde wig that's this that, like, mom haircut, you know, like the Karen haircut. She's one of the friends, or she's one of the kids that went to high school with Tina Fey's character, who finally tell her, like, you were the mean one. You were the one that were like, that was talking crap about me the whole time. Everyone heard what you said under your breath. You sucked. And so she was one of those women.
Yeah, that's funny because she had, like, she definitely had a few moments, but I feel like she was just kind of like a steady working actor, like forever. Like, she's probably roughly similar in age to us, a little older, maybe. Mm-hmm. She's in that Cobra Kai thing briefly as, you know, the same character, obviously. But anyway, that's who she is. Now, you mentioned she's going to end up, you know, hooking up with this other guy. He is Harley, so named because he rides around a motorcycle in the school.
Right.
Which I just want to bring that up because this is, you know, this is what makes Parker Lewis special, is that it's a live action cartoon. I feel like, you know, it's like we talked about, it's a single camera sitcom when that wasn't very common.
Yeah, 1990.
Yeah. And there's all of these touches like that, like all the weird little sound effects and transitions and things like the guy who rides a motorcycle inside the school, you know? And so, yeah, that's just sort of part of the DNA of Parker Lewis.
Yeah. So Parker realizes that the girl he wants to ask him is not bold enough to ask him, right? He hears from his friend Mikey that she was asking about him in class and said that she was interested. And we find out later that the reason she said that to Mikey was because she wanted Parker to ask her because she was nervous to ask.
Right.
So she says that, and then and so Parker's like, all right, if she's too scared to ask me, I'm gonna give a seminar on confidence.
Yeah.
So he does a full, like, late night kind of telemarketer sort of Donahue version of a seminar for confidence.
I went right to Tom Cruise in Magnolia. This is the Frank Mackey respect the cock, like crazy seminar, you know, like that's, you know, a big part of that movie is it's one of Tom Cruise's best performances ever is this insane seminar he gives for incels, basically, that's, you know, trying to give them techniques to be more seductive. Yeah. And so Parker has decided that, you know, the whole school, but especially this one girl that he has his eye on, you know, everybody's too shy. They need more confidence. And so, yeah, he takes to the stage. His outfit is ludicrous.
Oh, man, like, that tie alone.
Everything is gigantic. And his shirt is tucked in, but it's bloused up so much and so gigantic that it's like a mushroom where like the sides of it just hang down below him. And the armpits are like a squirrel suit that you would use to like fly, you know, to like jump off a cliff or something. Like they're just like,
he didn't just have parachute pants. He had parachute shirt.
Yeah. Like he truly looks amazing. And yeah, he gives this talk where he has all of these examples of people that he says are ugly,
right? But they, like, have confidence.
Yeah. And his examples are Prince and Madonna.
Well, he says, like, Prince got Kim Basinger, which I was like, I didn't even know they were together. And then his other one is Madonna, face of a collie.
Yeah.
Why is she successful? Confidence. And I'm like, hold on, Madonna has a face of a collie? What's going on?
I don't know exactly what the joke is supposed to be there. But yeah, his whole thing is that all of these famous sexy people are ugly, but they have confidence. That's really it. Like, that's the crux of his speech. And it works as though it was like a Pied Piper hypnotizing type thing. Like, it works like magic. Again, the cartoon logic of the show.
Everybody, when they leave his seminar, now is asking the person they want to go to the dance. And so the next day at school, everyone is coupled up, including this girl that he has wanted to ask him. She comes up to him and she's like, oh, Parker, thank you so much. I finally got the confidence to ask because of you. I'm so excited. I can't wait to go to the dance. And then she jumps on the back of the Harley because that's the guy that she asked. That's the one that she was too scared to put herself out there for.
Yeah. And so that's the sort of crisis that you talked about. There's all kinds of other wacky stuff going on. Another overlapping trope, Jerry, his nerd friend, is dating his sister.
Right, his Shelley. Sister tags him because she wants him to be like the fix everything the way he does.
Yeah, like her personal assistant, basically.
The way he does for Parker. So she tags him and gets him to be his, like you said, personal assistant.
Yeah. So Parker goes to Robin Lively, Tracy, whatever her name is, and they have this quiet talk. It turns out She's broken up with Harley because he cheated on her, right?
Yeah, well, so Parker goes to tell her that this Harley guy is two-timing her.
And she's like, yeah, I knew
and
that.
And he chickens out. He walks away because he doesn't, like I was saying, he doesn't want to upset her. She looks happy, even though it's not the best relationship, like whatever. And he chickens out and he walks away. And the only reason he gets the confidence to do that in the first place is because his friend, Jerry, plays the You Can Be Confident seminar in his bedroom in the middle of the night when he's feeling sad,
right,
to like liven him back up. And so like Jerry kind of pulls a Parker on Parker.
Yeah.
And so he goes to talk to her and then chickens out. And then she follows him and sits down and is like, I know you want to tell me, but I already know.
Yeah. So she's like, I already knew that. So you didn't need to tell me. And then she asks him, like, I just feel like this is another one where the story just kind of ends with a whimper. Like, he doesn't do anything.
No, he does. She asks him to the dance. She basically is like, who would you go to the dance with if I were you, you know, if you were me? And then she's like, you know, because I think I want to go to the dance with you. Like, she sort of realized that she shot for the moon. Like, she didn't have the confidence to ask out the bad boy because she didn't really want to be with the bad boy. And she really wants to kind of be with Parker. So she's going to go be with Parker and give that a try.
Yeah. This one, like, I can't figure this out. Like, in terms of tracking the trope, the events are the same. Like, the girls ask guys dance gives you a context for, like, you know, okay, it shakes things up a little bit. It means that the guys, we can't just ask the girl. They need to figure out a scheme to make it happen. So, okay. But then, like, everything beyond that, I don't know, like, even for Parker Lewis, it's just a weird story. Like, I guess you start with Parker does a seminar for the school to help everybody be confident, right? Like, that's why you do this episode, I guess. Like, you know what I mean? I'm trying to figure out, like, what was the germ of the thing, you know? Like, with Donna Reed, obviously they had access to Don Drysdale. Couldn't pass that up, you know?
Like, no, I think the germ probably was like, hey, why don't we do a Sadie Hawkins kind of dance? What would Parker do at if it was a Sadie Hawkins dance? Oh, Parker would probably do this. And then what can be the complication? Oh, the girl doesn't end up asking him, right? But in the end, they want to have the little happy ending. So they, you know, she has a realization. I think you're right. I think all of these kind of end, like both Punky and this one end with a whimper because the story is about the guy, not the girl.
Yeah. I mean, it makes sense. Look, I think it would be totally fine to have the girl's point of view. You know, that would be good too. The notion that you can't ask somebody, you need to be asked. And so, you know, what do you do with that? Like, that means you need to come up with something. Like, I guess that is a solid premise. I guess it checks out. Like, now that I'm thinking about it more, like, yeah, and the idea that he would essentially hypnotize the school with his charismatic seminar, right, but sort of miss the mark. All right.
For himself,
okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I stand by my comment that it ends weirdly, but it is a solid use of the trope, I think.
Yeah,
but
I think
three for three in terms of we never get to go to the dance.
Yeah, don't go to the dance. Now, that won't be true at our next episode because every Strangers with Candy episode ends with the cast dancing.
Okay, well, on that note, let's move on to Strangers with Candy.
Season 1, Episode 5, Bogey Nights.
Yep, we've never covered this before. I had very little familiarity with this. We were in college when this came out in 1999, and I remember this being a thing, but I wasn't even sure if it was a sitcom. I knew it was a Comedy Central thing, and I knew it had Amy Sedaris, but I was sort of mystified by its whole existence. But you liked this, right?
So I didn't watch a ton of it, but I watched some, right? Like, I think I watched more of it than you did. I can't remember what it came on after, but I feel like it was either like a lead-in to The Daily Show or it came on after something else that I watched on Comedy Central. But yeah, this was one that I've seen a little bit of. But it was one of these ones, even in that, like, in that time, it felt so subversive that I thought it was really fun. And I liked Stephen Colbert, who was on The Daily Show at the time. And it was fun to see him, like, in an acting role as well as the kind of correspondent role he was doing on The Daily Show. So it was fun to kind of watch both. But yeah, so the whole premise of Strangers with Candy is it is written like it's an after-school special, but it's an after-school special where you always learn the wrong lesson, right? So the characters all make bad decisions, even though everything's leading them to make better decisions. And then the takeaway from the wrong decision is the wrong takeaway. So, like, they never learn a lesson. They always, and they have these, like, whacked out premises, right? So that's kind of like the idea for the show. And then the whole deal of the show is that you have Amy Sedaris's character, who plays Jerry Blank, who's a 46-year-old user, loser, abuser. Like, that was like the tagline or something along those lines. And she is coming back to high school after 32 years of being a drug addict and a prostitute and a money launderer. And so now she's restarting her life as this teenager when she first ran away from from home. And she lives with her dad, who throughout the whole, like, I think first and second season, whenever you see him, he is absolutely still. He does not move. And her stepmom, that she doesn't like very much. And she is back at school, in high school, trying to, like, get in with the cool girls and, like, be a part of high school life in this weird way, because she's this 46-year-old woman, but she only acts like a teenager. Like, there is no mention, like, there's nobody around her who's like, oh, this is weird because you can't date high schoolers because you're 46. It's all just like, yeah, you had all this lost time. You're legit starting over. You're 16.
Yeah, there is an absurdist tone to this show that is very much, you know, infiltrates every molecule of it, to the extent that I didn't know whether, even though she refers to herself as a 47-year-old high school student or however, I didn't know that backstory. So I didn't understand whether it's supposed to be like, she's just a 47-year-old student, the way that there might be a student that's a koala bear or something, like just something that didn't even have any rhyme or reason to it. The credited writers on this show are Amy Sedaris, Stephen Colbert, and Thomas Lennon, who's from The State, the MTV sketch show. So those are all people that I was really into, but for short form stuff, yes, or for, you know, a talk show or a crazy sketch show. Thomas Lennon does write movies, but that's almost like this shadow career he has where he writes like mainstream family movies. But it's always kind of a tough sell for me when you take that wild, absurdist sensibility, you know, just that sort of that mentality where, like, the last thing we're interested in doing is sincerely telling a story or formulate characters or something. We want to, like, experiment, and we want to do, just like you said, like, what if there was a family sitcom, but all the lessons were reversed, and playing with the form and all kinds of stuff like that. It's so interesting, but for me, it always makes it like, yeah, I'll watch a couple of these, yeah, but it's never going to be my main thing.
Yeah, you know? No. And I think what you're picking up on is exactly why it only lasted for about 3 seasons. It never was a ratings hit. Now it's like a cult thing. Like, people love it. You're either obsessed with it or you're not into it. Watching it again now, like, I definitely remember back in the day thinking those jokes were so funny, and how funny it was that they were like, they would say all these things that were so not PC. Like, in the very beginning, it's like Arbor Week and she's planting a tree, and she's like, oh, you know, I know you're not a real federal holiday, but that's okay. None of the Jew holidays are either. Like, and just the way she kind of like says that kind of stuff, yeah, like, oh my gosh, she said that, you're not supposed to say stuff
late
like
90s
that.
Sense of humor for,
yes,
sure.
And so, but I just remember thinking, and then of course at the very end, she chops, like, the end of Arbor Week, so she chops down the tree. She's like, hope you enjoyed your time in the sun, little tree, and chops it down rather than like letting it live. And the whole point of Arbor Day, you know, plant the tree, let it live there forever. She plants it in the middle of a baseball field, so that wasn't going to work anyway. But it's just like every little thing about it is like upside down. You know what I mean? Everything's kind of backwards, opposite land. And yeah, and I just remember thinking that was really funny, and I would always get a bunch of good chuckles out of watching it. But looking back at it now, watching it back now, it reminds me of going back to some, like, the Sarah Silverman program.
Yeah.
And watching old Sarah Silverman stuff and being like, oh yeah, I remember when those jokes, like I remember when I laughed at those jokes. And it's like the thing of where comedians are like, oh, you can't make a joke anymore. It's like, no, just humor has changed, and that's for the better. Like, it's good. We've evolved and we're glad for it. But yeah, like, I used to think that's funny. I don't think that's funny anymore.
Yeah. And this doesn't have, to me, as much of the, like, sort of politically incorrect stuff, but it definitely has the audacity, like you're talking about. There's a running joke where they talk about the violent students, right? This is 99, so I'm wondering, is this before or after Columbine? Is this a joke they're making in reference to Columbine, or a joke that they can only make because Columbine hasn't happened yet?
Oh, wait for it. The reason this got written in is because they were shooting in an abandoned school in Rutherford, New Jersey, and the school had a padded room. And because of that, they decided in this episode This is the very first introduction of the violent students that became a running theme throughout the series, because this is episode 5. And it was only due to the fact that the school had a padded room and they didn't have to do any set decoration. That was the room. And they were like, that's really funny. And then they started riffing on it and they were like, what could that have been used for? Oh, it must be because of violent students. And then that just became a thing.
Yeah. And they love that phrase again, very 90s, that sort of like, oh, we just have a certain way of saying it that we think is very funny. And so they love to reference the violent students. But the main crux of this story is going to be, if you could call it this, like a very broad satire, I guess. There's a new student in town, and the sort of joke of the episode is everybody is racist against new people.
Right. It's a satire of immigration.
Yeah,
right?
Xenophobia.
That's what it's all about. Like, the kid is new in town. And we saw a little bit of this in the first couple of episodes when Jerry's the new student. So you notice that sometimes when they refer to this new student, they call him the new student. And that is because she was the new student up until now. So even like she'd been struggling to gain acceptance. And because he's there, now we're seeing the people, and we have seen in a few of the other episodes a little bit of like beginnings of acceptance, but that whole thing of like, we don't like new and the new kids are always bad and I've got my eye on you, the principal says, and all that is from the whole like, that's been in the show already, and now we've got a new student that is from Florida, and he lives with foster parents, which foster parents usually can't move you out of state, but who knows. So Jerry's like, oh yeah, I used to live in Florida about 15 years ago. And so we get the seeds planted right from the beginning that Jerry is probably this kid's mom, but she never realizes it, like all the way up until the very end. She finally figures it out and he figures it out. So yeah.
There's layers to this sort of silliness and absurdity because, yeah, you have the joke that people react to a new kid as though they are racist or xenophobic, but there's the added silliness of every character, even the ones that should be reasonable, benevolent characters, like the school principal or her parents or the teacher or literally every other person, are just like so remorselessly anti-new, you know? So when he comes to the classroom, Stephen Colbert, the teacher, I wrote this down because I feel like it just perfectly summarizes this kind of 90s absurdist writing. He says, all the desks are taken by real students. I'll have to ask you to sit on that box of slightly irregular jeans. You know, so everything's just like very wordy, lots of like fun, weird touches thrown in there. It's like this mild-mannered professorial kind of teacher that you think would be an enlightened person is the first one to say, like, I hate you because you're new, you are not a real student, and every single person except Jerry reacts to him like that.
Right. Well, and even she does too. I mean, for the most part. So she goes, the bell rings and they're going to leave Stephen Colbert's class, and she drops her notebook, and Ricky and she both lean down at the same time to pick it up. So there's our little meet cute. And just as they're like about to exchange their first couple of words, in swoops Stephen Colbert as the teacher. And he's like, gotcha. I've been waiting for you to slip up ever since you walked in here a few minutes ago. And off he gets, the new kid gets shipped to the principal's office because he talked to a girl.
Yeah. So, yes, they have a straight up star-crossed lovers thing. This is your standard. We have a secret love, essentially.
That's like right. She has 15-year-old falls madly in love with a 46-year-old. Why not?
Yeah. So they do the thing of like, you know, don't listen to what I'm saying.
You know, like, and she's like slashing his tires and taking the tire iron and smashing in the window that's on the, you know, passenger side of his car. And she's like, don't listen to any of the things that I'm doing. Just listen to my words. I really like you. I'm thinking I might want to ask you to the dance, but I don't know if I'm going to be allowed to.
Yeah. So we haven't really talked about it, but once again, Sadie Hawkins, right? This time we've gone back to calling it Sadie Hawkins for this one, right? That is mentioned. Yeah. I feel like it's like we always say, by 1999, All you really need to do is mention the trope and everyone knows it because it's a trope.
So, yeah, you don't have to go into any more detail than that. Just say it's a Sadie Hawkins dance and everybody's on board.
Right.
So now she goes home after this like interaction. She goes home and we get that great scene in the kitchen where the stepmom is like and the brother comes in and is teasing Jerry like, oh, I think you're going to ask the new kid. And the stepmom's like, don't you dare talk like that in my house. Not even joking.
Yeah. And she does the whole thing of like, oh, of course, new people seem nice until you agitate them or whatever. Just to get like really hammering home, like trying to speak about it in exactly the same way that like racist people do.
That's right.
But so when she ultimately asks him to the dance, it is just very much like, it's what this kind of show and this characterization is. You know, we should mention she's doing this whole performance. Again, I'll invoke Fire Marshal Bill. You know, she's doing a weird thing with her teeth, sort of curling her lip. She's doing a weird voice, you know, so it's
yeah, again, she's got this big overbite and she wears a fat suit, but only on the bottom half of her body.
I didn't even notice.
Yeah.
That.
So she's got these like, cause she's a very petite woman. She didn't have big hips. And so she has this weird, like padded fat suit that's only around her hips and her kind of gut to make that part look like she looks more middle-aged.
Yeah. So it's a SNL type character from the jump. And then this scene where she's going, okay, we're going to have a scene where my character is really nervous about asking him to the dance. So it is very much a spoof of that kind of acting.
Yes.
You know,
it
is her.
He sneaks into her window, like, you know, as all these teen shows would have. And she's like, oh, I really like you. And I'd like to, you know, she says that, you know, I'd like for you to put all of that in my ear or something like that. And then she opens her legs and he's like, oh, mommy. And she's like, what? And so once again, we're like, oh, right. This is like, she's his mom.
Yes. I did not catch on to that yet. But yeah, she's just doing the like, and I, just like really just having fun with exaggerating that thing. To
I love that you didn't realize from the beginning, oh, they were dropping all the clues about. I love it when, oh my god, that always makes me laugh when it's like, I'm like, oh yeah, everybody knew by now. And Jay's like, no, not me.
Why does she have a Confederate flag in her bedroom?
Oh my gosh, because they do everything that is like, let's make people uncomfortable. Yeah, her bedroom has like the window shade is a Confederate flag. And so it's pulled partway up. So we're only seeing like half of it. But yeah, it's just like, it just goes to show that she's a horrible person. Like at every turn, she's yucky.
Yeah. But she takes him to the dance and she gives a speech. We actually get to go to the dance, mm-hmm, right?
Yep,
and
we
have
go to
a
the
big
dance.
Speech.
So what's been kind of happening in the, as like a side plot is that there's this boy that likes her and that likes Jerry, and he made her a friendship poster at the beginning of the episode and gives it to her, and she doesn't care. She's remade the friendship poster into a poster for Ricky. She gives it to Ricky. The guy that made her the poster in the first place sees him carrying the poster that has been remade for him. He gets all upset and he goes around telling the whole school that Jerry is going to go to the dance with him and that the new kid is bad news, like they already knew and he's bad. And so they have to jump him at the dance because he's bad news and he's with Jerry. And so that's what, like, Jerry stops them from, you know, they all have, the theme of the dance is golf. And that's why the episode is called Bogey Nights, because bogey is a golf term. And so the kids all the kids at the school have golf clubs and stuff, and they're going to beat the crap out of Ricky. And Jerry steps in front and is like, no, this isn't okay. You know, I was the new kid once and it wasn't fair and, you know, whatever. And then he's the new kid. And she doesn't really say anything. Like, it's another one of these, like, she doesn't ever learn any lessons. She's not trying to teach people anything. She basically is just like, and you shouldn't beat anybody. You know, you shouldn't beat anybody just for being new, as about all she gets out, when one of the violent kids who she actually took to the dance, because she chickens out and doesn't go to the dance with the new kid.
Okay. Because he's getting ready to leave town.
Right. He comes to the dance to tell her that he's going to move away because she didn't ask him. At the last minute, she chickened out and didn't and told him she couldn't go with him. Mm-hmm. And so she went with one of the violent kids, Spike, because special ed teachers were trying to do something new by making the violent students feel included and getting the other kids to ask them to go to the Sadie Hawkins dance.
Yes, it's like an outreach.
That's an outreach, right? So she ends up going with Spike, one of the violent kids, and then Ricky shows up and is like, hey, I'm going to leave. And they're having this conversation. And so the guy that has been mad, that likes Jerry, not Spike, the other guy that's her friend, is like, that's it. He's here. Everybody get him. And so they go and like, they're going to get him. And Jerry's like, no, we shouldn't beat up on the new kids because there's nothing wrong with new kids. I mean, there's a lot wrong with new kids. They're pretty bad. But also, let's not beat him up. And then Spike is like, rah! Ah, that's my date, and jumps off the stage, and everything turns into mayhem. And somehow there's a golf cart in there, and Jerry jumps in the golf cart, drives it into Spike, knocking him out, and then gets Ricky in the golf cart, and they screech on out of there into the parking lot.
Again, because of the general absurdist tone of this show, I thought that maybe the golf cart was just her car. And that was just like how she got around.
Maybe, but I thought it was because of the theme of the dance.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. But yeah, after this big, chaotic scene at the dance, we get the more intimate moment in the golf cart with the new kid and Jerry, and everything kind of comes out.
Right. He's like, yeah, the only thing I have for my mom is this tooth, and I want you to have it because I really am leaving. I'm not going to run away, like I said, but my foster family's moving, so we're going to go. And she's like, oh, wow, that's so cool. And she smiles really big, and he's like, and he kind of cocks his head, and she goes, oh, you noticed the gap. Yeah, I lost this tooth in Florida about 15 years ago. And he goes, oh, well, maybe you could use the one I gave you to fill the gap. And she's like, oh, that's fun. And she puts it up in there, and she's like, it's a perfect fit. And then they kiss, and which is really weird because, like, we already know, well, maybe Jay didn't, but I did, that they were mother and son. And I was like, ew, gross. And so, and then he realizes that, wait, if it's a perfect fit, when did you, like, you said you lost that tooth in Florida. I'm from Florida. And then it all comes out, like, okay. So now we've got episode 5. Of her redemption story, she's made out with her son.
Yeah. And she's still into it. Like,
yeah.
There's she's a like, point where she going? Says, can we still make out? And Blech. He's like, no. And yeah, he's like, yeah, it would be fine if we could just be friends, but I still have to move. And yeah, it wasn't meant to be. Yeah, look, this one, you got your wish in terms of it takes the female point of view, and it definitely has fun with that in terms of, like, throwing in this whole xenophobia angle. What if it was a Sadie Hawkins dance and you had someone you wanted to ask? That was a controversial choice, you know? So it takes that angle. Yeah, for me, like, this is definitely fun. Like I said, as a huge fan of Thomas Lennon and Colbert and all these people, 90s absurdity in general, like, I can definitely groove to it, but at the same time, like, there is a weirdness to it. Like I said, having her character be so sort of extreme in the center of it makes it just kind of hard to get into. And like, the sense of humor, it's like there's a harshness to it, even though it's not like super mean-spirited or anything. There's just a little bit of a harshness to it that makes it like not very cozy.
No, it's not very cozy. It's super surreal. Yeah. It's meant to like feel off-putting. Like, I remember, like, yes, I would laugh at it. I would get good chuckles, but it was like you always felt like dirty for thinking it was funny. It was like, God, this is not like doing the, like, it's not teaching the right lessons.
It's the MO of 90s humor writ large.
Well, so the other thing that I wanted to mention just on like the origins of this character that Amy Sedaris plays. So in the, I guess, like 50s, there was, in 50s and 60s, there was this motivational speaker that would go around to schools. Her name was Florrie Fisher. And this was her story. She was, had been, a prostitute. She had been like a drug addict and had gotten involved in all sorts of like money laundering schemes and stuff. And so she would go and talk to high school students. She also had an autobiography. And so a bunch of like lessons learned and things that Amy Sedaris's character says in this series come directly from her autobiography, from that lady's autobiography. And I just find that like so funny and ridiculous, even more to know that this like is based off of an actual person that would like, instead of going back to high school, would go back to high schools to teach. So it just cracks me up. I find it so, and it's, I find it so interesting.
Yeah. Well, and it's, yeah, it's such an interesting undertaking because it's like, obviously she can't assume that people know who that person is. So it's just like something that she finds funny that she is like bringing to us.
Right.
I think it's cool. You know, we didn't mention, I think this is a Comedy Central show, right?
Right.
And so this is sort of, you know, encapsulating that moment again, late 90s, early 2000s, where you could have this, you know, Viva Variety or Reno 911, you know, these shows where, you know, a somewhat popular but kind of weird comedian like Amy Sedaris could just be like, yeah, I have this idea, you know, like, I don't know, it's kind of out there, but it's like a half hour comedy and it goes like this. And they would just kind of go like, yeah, you know, she seems to know what she's doing and just let her do it. You know, like it's these concepts that, you know, you just can't imagine, you know, would be easy to get corporations on board
on
with.
Board.
You know,
well, they would give them. They had done like this group of them, Amy Sedaris and Paul Dinello and Stephen Colbert and I think one other guy had done a sketch show that had been on Comedy Central prior to this. And then at the end of that little kind of short-lived sketch show thing, Colbert and Rouse were trying to develop a show and Paul Dinello and Amy Sedaris were trying to develop a show. And this kind of character was Amy and Paul Dinello's idea that they would try to like do something about this character. And so they both were going in to pitch around the same time. And because they're friends or whatever, somehow Colbert, you know, they like Colbert and Rouch were told, hey, Amy and Dinello are doing this idea. And like, do you guys want to kind of team up or whatever? And Colbert was like, shoot, their idea is better than ours. Like, we've got to team up with them because they'll get picked up. And that is what happened. They did get picked up. So they ended up like throwing in their hat with the right thing. And so, yeah, that's how it came about that they all did this like another show together.
So looking back over these, what do we think? We've got, what, 30, 40 years of sitcomery here. Who wore it best?
Who wore it best? Oof. I really liked Donna Reed. It didn't do the thing that we talk about the black and white TV shows, like oftentimes those older TV shows kind of just drawing that straight line all the way down from like you can see where it's going from the beginning to the end.
Yeah.
It actually had a little bit of we're going to change things up and there's going to, you know, I don't really know how they're going to get back to this. How's he going to get out of that?
Kept us guessing.
Yeah. No, it was the umpire thing of it, you know, just like how was that character going to deal with that conflict? So I thought that was kind of interesting. Yeah, I think that probably is my favorite.
This is, I think, a lineup that has a lot of like sketchiness for me. Like there's not a solid family ties or something to nail it to sort of anchor it, you know, to supply that, you know, dare I say quality, you know, to kind of keep us on track.
No, but we do have these like kind of subversive shows, you know, all the way, other than Donna Reed, right? Like kind of all the way through. And I think that it has been fun to watch them all together and see why they were right in their time for their little short-lived window, because all of them were kind of short-lived, right? Or the last two anyway, Parker Lewis and Strangers with Candy, because they were doing something just a little bit off. And so they were a nice palate cleanser when you're stuck with all the same old, same old. But when you watch them all together, there's no palate to cleanse. So it's just a little bit like,
Yeah, no, in fact, it's the opposite. Like you need to watch Leave It to Beaver to cleanse yourself of Strangers with Candy. My thinking was the first two shows were very fun in that sitcom study way. The Donna Reed thing with the baseball game and the, you know, you can't tell anybody apart because everybody's white people with the same exact haircut and the goofy, you know, baseball player acting and then just the utter insanity of Punky Brewster, all the things we talked about, all the craziness there, you know, we don't need to relitigate that. Those two were very sort of fun and kind of quintessential, like, this is why we watch old sitcoms. And then the last two, I would use the word off-putting. You know, they're the kind of, I'm not going to say that I'm going to have nightmares or anything, but like I said, Parker Lewis, that weird stare, those dimples, he's a little bit of a psycho. And yeah, this Amy Sedaris character, like the whole world she creates is, it's funny, but it's also a little weird and off-putting. And so, yeah, I don't know.
I think it's more than off-putting, but yeah, I think it's purposefully.
By the time she is requesting to make out with her grown son, you know what you're in for. So yeah, a wild ride with the Sadie Hawkins dances. But I guess just the final word on it in terms of the trope, you know, like we said, we only got one actual dance. It really is just more of like a, just sort of like an overarching thing that you could throw out there, especially in the 20th century, of like, oh, Sadie Hawkins Day, girls need to ask the boys, so come up with a fun story.
The drama in the Sadie Hawkins is not the actual dance. The drama is the who's going to ask who and what's going to happen leading up to it.
Yeah. So, you know, you give a seminar, you threaten to throw yourself off of a fifth story ledge, you know, all the usual things.
You umpire a baseball game or you, key a car and slash some tires.
Yeah, drive a golf cart. All right. So much for the Sadie Hawkins dances. What are we talking about next week?
Next week, we are saying goodbye to our nearly happily ever after couples in our Will They, Won't They series. It'll be episode 50, which means it's part 5, and all of our couples are going off into the sunset, maybe happily ever after, maybe. So we've got Cheers season 5, episode 26, I Do Adieu. Friends, Season 10, Episode 17, The Last One. Office, Season 5, Episodes 1 and 2, Weight Loss. And New Girl, Season 6, Episode 22, 5 Stars for Beezus.
Yep, the epic conclusion of the Will They Won't They case study is next week. And until then, we will consider this segment of the sitcom study concluded. Thank you for listening to the Sitcom Study. Tell us what you think or share your own TV tropes and topic ideas by sending a self-addressed stamped email to sitcomstudypodcast@gmail.com or find us on Facebook or Instagram. And if you like the show, consider leaving a rating or review on your podcast app. It helps us boost those precious Nielsen ratings. The Sitcom Study is recorded in front of a live studio dog.